This episode contains discussion around sexual assault and sexual violence. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
I'm Amira.
I'm JW.
So, this week on Faith Uncut, we'll be discussing Church 2. Okay, hashtag Church 2. And Church 2 is born out of the Me Too movement, which, you know, if you've been under a rock, maybe you don't know what's going on. But there has been a recent social movement. The face of it is Tarana Burke. Other women have co-opted the hashtag Me Too. But it's basically a social media campaign to raise awareness around sexual assault and sexual violence. Originally, it was talking about women victimized, mostly by men, and calling attention to their examples. And it really took off in different professional circles because it was a very tight way to say inappropriate things happen here too. So we've seen Me Too start out at a community level, but it really took off with Hollywood actresses acknowledging that they've been victims. Recently, Harvey Weinstein, I believe, was charged, indicted for sexual assault. Multiple charges, actually, brought by women who've had to work with him through his movie business, his entertainment business. Most recent cases like Bill Cosby, even though that was going on before the hashtag Me Too movement, it experienced a resurgence because it has taken so much to get his trial completed, or the original trial with Andrea Constant completed. But what has happened is that, you know, again, because it was a really tight, on point way to say inappropriate things have happened or are happening in certain areas, it was inevitable that it would show up in a way acknowledging some of the behavior that happens in the church. So today we'll just be talking about a few things around that.
Sexual violence does occur in the church, and we do not have a lot of data on the rates at which this occurs, because a lot of it goes unreported. Rain, rape and abuse and incest national network estimated that the highest risk group for sexual assault are women between the ages of 12 and 34.
Wow.
But there was not data available for what goes on in churches. So a lot of the information is anecdotal. And the reason why this Church 2 hashtag is important, started by Emily Joy, is that these stories that were unable to be told or unheard are now being heard, and people are able to do this. And so you're getting a view now that you hadn't had before of how widespread sexual violence, to include sexual assault, sexual harassment, just grooming behaviors, those type of things going on in the church. People are seeing this now, and the church has to look at this and see what they've done what they've done in the past that has contributed to this, and how they're going to move forward.
So in last week's episode, right, we were talking about how there is this, I don't know, almost this innate ability in us as humans to want to cover things up. And so there's no real difference, right, when it comes to the church in doing some of the same things in terms of covering things up. And so to your point, right, the data isn't really there because the church has done a terrible or good job at covering it up. Right. I mean, like that's just what's happening. It doesn't mean that there are not these issues that have affected multiple groups of people. It does tend to, or at least it appears to be more women, right? For many reasons, but it is also, right, things happen to young boys as well. Things happen to grown men. They happen to a bunch of people. The predominant culture that it seems to happen to the most, though, it's true, it seems that it has been women.
Well, I mean, just when understanding what the root is on sexual assault or sexual violence. So even though it's more taboo because the word sexual is there, these are really power-based crimes, aggressive crimes. So that covering behavior has more to do with the fact that we don't openly talk about sex that much anyway, and also because there's a cultural inclination to cover for the behavior of men, no matter how negative that behavior might have been to somebody else. Groups that are not men, I don't know what other way to say that, but groups that are not, let's say, heterosexual men will experience this lack of power in that exchange. As long as that's happening out in the greater sense of the community, that's going to happen inside the church.
Mm. So the power dynamic is what contributes to these,
yes,
to these crimes of sexual assault. And
I was going to say, you just used the word crimes, mm-hmm, right?
Yeah.
You didn't call it sin.
No, I did not call it sin. So here's the thing. The Bible talks a fair amount about sin. It also discusses crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And in the church, specifically with sexual harassment, sexual assault, and these behaviors surrounding both of those, we have a tendency to treat crimes as sin. But crimes and sin are different.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is the Bible has a restorative process that is prescriptive for sin. That process is not the same for crimes. So in cases where we see, like, there was a pastor, Andy Savage, in Tennessee at his church called High Point, who had committed sexual assault, and mm-hmm, he got up before the church and admitted to this sexual assault. And so it was this, mm-hmm, this prepared statement that he had, and he wanted to come forward and admit this. Okay. But after that, the church gives him a standing ovation for, mm-hmm, this admitting this crime.
Mm-hmm.
And we just need to be careful that we are not implementing the prescriptive restorative process for sin and applying that to crimes, because they are handled differently, even in the Bible. So we should not be expecting to see sin, it getting sense, like crimes getting standing ovation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's not how that works. That right. someone was, like, traumatically harmed for that.
Yep.
And to have to see or even know about your body that you were a member of now is applauding your aggressor is tough.
But they're not applauding your aggressor for his aggression. I feel like they might be applauding the confessing, which again goes back to the sin, but we also confess to our crimes too. So I do think they were probably, again, allowing for conditioning, they were probably acknowledging, oh my gosh, we're so proud of you for confessing.
But that doesn't happen anywhere. Like, you're not in the police station and all the police officers are giving you a standing ovation because you were in an interview room and you confessed.
Right, and you finally confessed. But that's why we're even talking about this, because we recognize that the way that we acknowledge that even harm was done can make the wound fester.
Right.
Right. So if somebody's thinking, wow, finally you're going to take accountability for, you know, my innocence that you stole, or, you know, for being so aggressive toward me. And then they, like you said, visually or even have to know that the church body appeared to be accepting that it's happened. You're forgiven. You know, they want to do the atoning right then and there. That's going to make your wound fester. But are they really applauding that you were assaulted or that you were ever hurt? No, I think they're picking and choosing what they want to acknowledge. So I'm not really acknowledging your crime as much as I'm acknowledging your confession.
Does that person deserve applause?
No.
Do they deserve applause? No, period.
Okay.
There's an awkwardness that exists when somebody stands before you and says that. You just use the example of a confession in a police station. And what does that get you? Does that get you a standing ovation?
Right.
Mm-mm. But see, the police were actually in the business to get a confession out of you. So there may be an inward applause or some high fives outside outside the interview room. But that was the goal of that dialogue.
Right.
The goal was that in a church, when somebody says that, so in this case, that pastor stands up and says that, he's saying it, right? That was to get it off his chest for whatever the reason. He was trying to do something. But here's the thing. When that group of people, that congregation, people start clapping, a couple of things. One, everybody didn't clap. Two, there were some people when they were clapping, that clapping went from really fast to like, wait a minute, what are we doing?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know how to feel, because you're still trying to to process it. So I don't know what goes through somebody's mind when they clap in something like this, except for the fact that I personally believe in that moment, this goes to something you said, Amira, in that moment, you forgot about the victim. All you were just at that moment, you were just like, well, I mean, I guess it's good you said something. Right. But you weren't focusing in on the victim. So do they deserve a round of applause? No. Is that the way to treat it? No. But that goes back to your point about crime versus sin. Right. If it is a crime, it's a crime because there are laws in the land that would dictate and say that's wrong behavior. Mm-hmm. Right. But there's not a law for every sin that exists in the Bible. So sometimes in a church setting, some people can't grasp the fact that there is a difference. So when somebody stands and does that, I would tell you, no, they don't deserve a round of applause at all. I don't know what we are actually clapping for. If somebody says, well, you know, because now they got to be restored. I don't know about all that.
See, I'm sitting here saying that sometimes people exploit and manipulate. So they want you to see their crime as a sin because we congratulate sinners who confess and say that they're going to live differently. In fact, we believe that the confession of those sins are transformative. And they make you a whole new person. So if I don't necessarily, if I've been an aggressor, I could definitely see wanting to appeal to your idea of redemption, to what I think the body's idea of redemption is, because I'm going to go through that confession posture. I'm going to confess. I'm actually confessing a crime. There's actually secular laws that can deal with me. But I think that, you know, what we're saying as far as the church, too, and why is the church in this particular position of having to atone for actions that it took or did not take? It's because it, at many times, regardless of denomination, the church or the church's leadership wants to take the place of law enforcement. They want to do internal investigations. They want to prescribe a punishment, you know, and they may or may not say that it's, you know, along biblical principles, but that at that moment, they want those biblical principles to supersede state laws.
You know what's funny? I'm listening to you talk, and I can think of a couple of examples of where churches, there was an accusation of sexual assault, right? Sexual harassment or whatever the case may be. And all of a sudden, this is when I laugh. It's when a church releases a statement and the first part of that statement is, well, we're actually right now in doing an internal investigation. And when this has concluded, we will come out and we will tell you about the matter, right? That's not just their statement to the membership. What they're also trying to do is to release that statement, to your point, to law enforcement, to any legal entity to go, I got this, if y'all could just step back for a second. And so we're trying to put up this fake wall as if the church regulations for how they control the inside house, they want that to be for the case for the outside world. And it's not.
Nope.
It's not. It's not. I've told y'all before, I've been in church a lot. I've been in testimony services where somebody's been videotaped actually confessing to a crime. And then everybody sits there and goes, they just say what I think they said. Yeah. And then you have a cop, somebody's in the back of the room that goes, we're going to have to talk after this is over, and I'm going to need a copy of the
video. Or in somebody's testimony, they acknowledge that a crime was committed and that person might have not been prosecuted. I've seen it that way, acknowledging as a part of, let's say, a reclamation or an acknowledgement of their testimony and healing or whatever, or forgiveness, that an actual crime took place. And we don't, sometimes in that moment, we don't get into whether or not they felt supported by that church body. You got to think, so many different types of advice are going to come out, just like it does when you're having problems in your marriage, just like it does when you have problems with your kids. Some people are going to tell you, pray again, pray harder. Some people are going to, 1 out of 10 might say, have you thought about family therapy or something to that extent, you know, getting some outside help. Some people are not going to know what to say. It is the very same thing when people present with issue, whatever the issue might be. And when it comes to this particular, you know, why talk about sexual violence? Why talk about sexual assault within the church? Because I think that as much as we highlight some of the more negative or not so positive aspects of being a part of the body. And we've talked about the church and maybe not really acknowledging the full contribution of women. This eats at what's left over. So when you don't acknowledge my humanity, it's way easier to victimize me. And that's happening to more groups than just women, even mm-hmm. though we acknowledge that they mm-hmm. Probably have the most data because that's how it's been studied. But dare I say, if you look through the lens, those who experience the least amount of protection with their clothes on, likewise might be experiencing the least amount of protection and covering with their clothes off.
Hmm. All right, so I got to call bullshit on these church investigations. So here's the thing. If a crime has been committed, let's say the crime was, JW, you poisoned a mirror. All right. And so now I'm going to,
I don't really like where this is going.
I'm
going
to release a statement that says, I am investigating this incident and I will return at some point in the future with my conclusion. Okay. The way that investigation is going to go is I'm going to sit down with JW. I'm going to say, what'd you do? I'm going to sit down with a mirror. I'm going to say, what happened? You know, I'm going to look at whatever evidence there and, you know, I'm going to talk to my elder board. I'm going to come back, figure out how to spin this so that, you know, it's not awful. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, a mirror has been poisoned. So who's dealing with a mirror while her is trying to deal with this thing that was not a part of her before? And it's killing her.
And it's killing me.
So in the Army, they have the way their reporting works. If there's a sexual assault or sexual harassment or sexual assault claim, it is investigated. But while it's being investigated, that victim is receiving treatment. Medical treatment, psychiatric treatment. There's different things that are in place to uh-huh. take care of that person while that investigation goes on. Mm-hmm. Now, the church, even though some churches have law enforcement officers as a part of their body, they are not trained criminal investigators. Mm-hmm. So to say that we're going to investigate this and get back to you, you're not good at that. You're not a sin scene investigator. Like, that's not, you're not going to show up with your Bible, open up to Acts and say, well, you know, that's not how you are not qualified to do this. This was a crime and you don't have the luxury of taking the time and leaving that victim to sit with something that was not something that they chose.
See, but you have made this delineation, right? That isn't typically made. You keep doing sin, vice, crime, which is the right way to do it. But when churches start to do this internal investigation, here's what that really is. Again, it's the house business is about to get out in the street. Yep. So I got to get ahead of this. And what I need to do is now I got to protect this house. And how do I protect the house? Well, we're going to go through the process you just outlined to try to figure out what's wrong. Here is my challenge to it. I have two challenges. One, we don't actually know how to even deal with sin. So how are we going to now try to deal with the crime? How are we going to do that? Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense. There's no follow through thought to that. That to me is a part of the biggest issue. Here's the second issue I have. We don't even know how to corporately handle restoration according to the Bible. There are some things that are laid out in Galatians. I won't go through it, but there are things that are laid out on how to restore, mm-hmm. right? But if we don't get that right, then what we do is, I'll take your example. So now you come back as the pastor and you come back and you go, I've talked to everybody. And so this really wasn't a real poisoning thing. You know, they had a little disagreement. We've taken them together based on Matthew 18. It was me and them. And we talked through some issues. And so now we just going to keep them apart. Everything is good. Y'all don't worry about it. Let's go ahead and take up an offering. Let's sing a couple songs. Let's go home. Right. Because in somebody's mind, I have to cover up. This is my process for restoration. This is how I dealt with the sin. But the crime is still there. The victim in that moment is still there hurting. The victim was never, ever addressed, never cared for.
So I do feel like that leads to victim blaming, where if they seem unforgiving to...
Who's they?
If the victim seems unforgiving mm-hmm. to the aggressor, you know, because... whether there was a confession or not, if they appear to not want to rise above and then walk in that saintly path of I've forgiven you, that leads to victim blaming. And again, operating within a culture that sometimes slut shames women or blames victims of sexual assault for somehow attracting the wrong attention or giving the wrong signals, vibe, whatever. Again, that thing can happen inside the church where now the person is like, well, why do you dress like that? You know, or why would you go by yourself with the musician, the drummer or whatever? Why would you walk over there by yourself? Were you being fast? Nobody's really taking into account who chases fast girls. You know what I mean? It's always this girl is fast, but who's chasing her though? You know what I mean? So I just feel like until we begin to get, until we continue to get it right of giving victims parity, giving people who have been victimized parity, your word matters because it matters. You're going to have examples in the church where it's like sweep this under the rug because they're not a desirable victim. And they're not what we think a victim looks like. Skirt's too short. There's no way he did anything, you know, or enticement. What are these types of words? Those get thrown around when the victim doesn't look like what people think a victim should look like.
Yeah, but see, that's also, but the point you just made is, man, that's so true. We look too much. We're looking in the wrong direction, right? So the blame is on the young woman's attire as opposed to the treatment and how this man treated that particular person. It's never on. It's never that way, or rarely is it that way. Authority. I guess, right?
We keep talking about women authority, and men, but yes, there is something that happens between women as the aggressor and other groups. I just don't want to obscure it because I do want people to understand that we know.
Yeah,
I feel like the church's theology contributes to its inability to address these issues properly.
How so?
Okay.
So we know, as Amir acknowledged, that both, and JW also, that women are victims of sexual assault and so are men. We also know statistically that men are, by large amount, the majority of the perpetrators of sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if you look at what our theology says about women and how we view them, if we look at how, or what that says about, or what we believe it says about LGBTQIA people, or what we use it to say about LGBTQIA people, who are also a lot of times the men that are victims of another man's sexual assault. So if we're talking about this as a power dynamic, two groups that the theology has been used to marginalize and oppress is also being used, also makes way to silence them or make sure that their stories are not heard, not respected, not told at all. So we have to at some point deal with the fact that if we're using our theology to understand women, LGBTQIA folks, and that is incorrect, then we have to start and correct it there or while we are hearing these stories. We have to be open to that, but we can't let, you know, okay, so we talked about sin and crime and things like that. Everything doesn't reach the level of a crime. So, for instance, like you talked about comments about specific dress or, you know, church hugs that go on too long and things like that, you know, inappropriate touches and things like flirting and comments and stuff like that that are unwelcome. Or unsolicited and things like
harassment
sexual harassment type stuff. Like you're not going to go to your local police department, and you may not do that and say that, you know, for, you know,
might they told they said, to the they said
my, you know, my you're cleavage
right.
was out. They're not, that's not going to happen, but we still have a long way to go in terms of how we view these groups based on how our theology, how we interpret theology to inform our views about these groups. So I just feel like we got a lot of work to do in terms of learning where our personal and collective blind spots are because of our upbringing, environment, and because of our theology that is also contributing to some of these problems.
So we recognize that we're, you know, when we come into an awareness of where those contradictions are, that we're really trying to reconcile the cognitive dissonance that you've known one thing, but you've been behaving a different type of way. And it's true that the theology has contributed to the oppression and the dehumanization of these two larger groups, women and people who are in that LGBTQIA community across the span, crossing racial lines, crossing class lines, everything. So I feel like when you center the person, I feel like if we looked at an organizational example, we could look to the Catholic Church, right? Because they are still uncovering crimes that were perpetrated against children or perpetrated against women, mostly in their bodies by their leaders, by someone identified as the leadership. And they have moved from, let's say, wide-scale denials to obstruction, mm-hmm. to, because the obstruction was when they used to try to take those investigations and say, we'll do them internally. They'll right. go all the way up through the Vatican. They don't have to go through your local law enforcement agency. And what the state began to do, at least in this country, the state being the government began to do, is invoke where those separations between church and state occurred, and they occurred between sin and crime. So you can confess your sins and you can try to absolve yourself of your sins, but your crimes will be dealt with differently. The church, at least from my observer point of view, has moved from that obstructionist angle to one of more like a reluctant partner now. Now when the leader is or the person is identified, the church now has to assess the risk in even trying to protect them. So that has taken a long time. Likewise, it's probably happening in other organizations, other denominations. You go from, we'll take care of it, it's none of your business, we got it, to, this might cost us a couple million dollars if we don't get this right, you know, down the line, or whatever the case may be. So just looking at the example of the Catholic Church, I bet real money that other leaders in other denominations have said, how do we avert some of the risk that comes from people abusing their authority and their power in other people's lives?
So I have a question. Do you think that there is a difference in how the church treats the aggressor if they are just your average person in the community, vice how they treat the person if they are the leader of the church?
Of course.
Right?
Yes.
Right. There seems to be a big difference in how we do it, right? Because if they're an average member, at least I feel like, I don't know that I don't have data to mm-hmm. prove it right now, but I feel like if it's just your average member who is accused of being the aggressor, that person could be turned over to law enforcement and hung out to dry pretty quickly. Right. But if you get a person who's in leadership, there seems to be, whether it's the pastor, youth pastor, deacon, trustee,
someone a part
whomever,
of that structure.
Right?
Yeah.
It seems to be at that moment, that's when you start to get some of the more sensitive issues.
Well, I don't think the structure can cover someone who's not actively a part of it. So I don't think that anyone trying to protect a average church member, you might not find that structure does that for you because you're just not high enough up in it where it can absorb your foolishness, right? I wouldn't think that. I wouldn't think if you had a congregation of 1,000 that structure could do for one of the faces of the 1,000 mm-hmm. what it could do for the 50 who have been identified as a part of the ministerial leadership. It definitely can't do for that 50 what it can do for the 10 that the pastor, you know, has chosen or who have emerged as his inner circle, mm-hmm. right? And it definitely can't do for anybody what it can do for the person in the most amount of power, their family, if that's where they want it to go, right? So it might not, we don't want to slander the role of pastor or drag him down, but it might not even be pastor. You might find this covers his son, who's not a part of the mm-hmm. the structure itself, but he's a part of that family, mm-hmm. his nephew, you know. It's just like a powerful family like the Kennedys.
Yeah, I have an issue with that risk assessment that's done. And mm-hmm. and it's not just in churches. That is something where if you have your CEO of the company or that pastor of the church, if something happens to that person, all of these other people are impacted. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that is a calculation that's done in most places where a hierarchical structure exists. The victim is still not considered in this. Mm-hmm. And that's where I have the issue, right, where in this calculation, you've left out the piece that's critical to solving this thing.
Right.
Like, you've not even considered this. You're concerned with, if this pastor goes up on these charges, who's taking over the church? How is that going to make our church look? You know, how many members are we going to lose? How many, like, all of that stuff happens before the question of, is that person okay? oh my mm-hmm. God, this happened to this person. This is on us. Let's figure out how to deal with that.
Right.
And that's what I'm saying. Churches are not equipped for this, man. You can't have, like, the Vatican is doing criminal investigations. It's like, what are they doing? The Vatican is equipped to do a rape kit and fingerprints.
This was my struggle when that was happening in the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. If you are a Catholic Church and you are actually within the area of operation of the Vatican, got it. Because guess what? The Vatican actually is a bit of a governing body for that region, right? But if I'm in St. Louis and something happens, dog, you can't send me, who's accused of something, over to the Vatican for them to handle. It doesn't work that way. And I guess here's my issue with when we talk about the Catholic Church. We talk about women. We talk about LGBTQIA. Family members, but here's the other group that is also kind of left out. It's children. Mm. The number of assaults that are that have happened and are happening to children because it's some of the same thing. So, Amira, this goes to your point, right? We don't want to gloss over any group, mm-hmm. but as I'm sitting here, that's what I'm thinking about. Yeah, so when I think through what happened in the Catholic Church, you have numerous kids, young boys, young girls, whomever, coming forward to say this. And can you imagine what happens when they come forward and somebody goes, oh, baby, that didn't happen. That didn't really mean that, or that it wasn't that bad. And so what are we doing? We're starting to cover up and sweep, and you sweep it up under a rug until you can't do that anymore. And at some point, all of that just starts to come out.
But I feel like that happened to them. So even though things have been happening to children, it was the adults. It was the children who survived it and turned into adults who began to hold the organization responsible or accountable for what happened to them. And what happened and what appeared to happen is that it was like dominoes. The people who kicked open the door that the church wanted to immediately discredit or wanted to say, oh, we did something about that. It opened the door into what exactly was an archdiocese investigation prior to oversight. And what it used to be was identification and transfer. You've been identified as somebody who's done something crazy. We're going to transfer you somewhere else. Now, speaking about the isms that create false barriers, structural barriers to justice, those leaders who are identified in certain parishes or certain archdioceses as being negative mm-hmm. were transferred to places where vulnerable people lived. So if you're not good enough to serve over there in that particular tax bracket or that particular zip code, why are you coming over here? Why are they willing to transfer you from, let's say, an Orange County to a South Central LA? Why are they doing it? Who does that endanger? And that endangers, you know, those of us who experience intersectionality in these groups that are oppressed. So that is a huge danger. If an investigation has happened and it involves, you know, children who look and behave a certain type of way, live in a certain area, when you remove that aggressor or that predator from that area to somewhere else, mm-hmm. I'm putting him with an even more vulnerable group that law enforcement is not inclined to really, you know, not so much not inclined, but maybe they don't have the track record of support and.
Well, but remember, it's already been covered up. So by the time you get to a new area,
right, nobody people are acting like anything. It's not even you.
Right.
But who does that put at the most danger? People who are already in vulnerable positions anyway. So it's kind of the same thing. When we begin to center victims, mm-hmm. And like we say, when you can do all this stuff to the aggressor, to the predator, but the victim is still sitting out here untreated or still experiencing a lack of justice. But when you center the victims, you have turned the organization on its head. And it's just, I don't know what we're expecting to see when you are literally asking somebody to walk upside down. Victims are not necessarily centered. Your most oppressed, your most marginalized groups are not necessarily out in front. So for us to get this right, it goes back to other conversations we've had about getting out of our own way.
Mm-hmm. Victims need the churches to advocate for them. So it is unreasonable and inhumane to expect someone who has experienced a trauma mm-hmm. to also be on the front lines to obtain that justice.
Yep.
To obtain those services that they need now as a result of that trauma. But that is the role that sexual assault victims have been forced into in our country, in our planet, in our faith spaces. So since we're talking about our faith spaces and some of the shortcomings of how we handle some of these events, which are crimes in some cases, we need to be sure that the church as the collective body is the advocate on behalf of that victim. Now, if there's an investigation to be done, let the people who have experience in investigating perform the investigation.
Yep.
And while that's happening, the church can do what a church does and support that person.
Yep.
They can, and the church should be good at this, so we don't have to lay out the plan for this. But the key thing in terms of church addressing this thing that's new to them, just like the situation in the Catholic Church was new to them at some point. The key to them addressing this is to hear and believe and support those victims. And then we can start to actually get somewhere. Like, I mean, like you said, get out of your own way. You're not the investigator.
That's right.
You're not qualified for that. And that person needs something that you actually are qualified for. So we need to be victim advocates as a collective body.
Yeah.
And that means you get. So here's the thing. I talked about the military before. They have different ways of reporting. So they have restricted and unrestricted reporting.
Okay.
So in a restricted reporting context, the victim will report to certain persons that are qualified, like a sexual assault advocate or medical professional or something like that. And that would not be releasable information. Meanwhile, they're able to get treatment and things like that. In an unrestricted sense, that's reported as a crime. And the persons who are able to receive that information are able to receive. I think that model is actually helpful because it gives some power back to the victim to say, how do you want to handle this? You get to choose. And so there are things that we can adopt in our faith spaces to help us deal with this better, to help us support these people who need our support better. And then we have to deal with conversations around consent. Conversation, like there's a lot of stuff that has to happen. And in the church, you know that deacon is not, you know how he does, like, and that's not okay.
Right.
So let's not, let's act like it's not okay now. Right. Let's act like, and you got to start at some point. So why isn't the point right now?
Yeah.
See, there's a lot of work to be done, period. But I think the reason sometimes we don't do it is because we get so overwhelmed with, well, here are the steps you got to take. Here are the implications from all of these steps. Instead of thinking through all of that, and we got to take one step, take one step at a time. You just talked about, I don't remember kind of how you did your 3 points, but like, I got to give somebody room to talk. I got to believe them and I got to support them, right? I got to do those things. So just take those steps. I understand that the rest of it is going to feel like hell, but imagine what the victim feels like. So if the organization has to go through hell, it just may have to be that way. Okay. Like, we can't be so afraid of that, because if we are, then all we're ever going to do is protect ourselves and we will forget about the victims.
And I feel like we didn't mention this, and I don't know that, you know, we're the right people to mention this, but we do. And I think it's important for churches to acknowledge, if they're trying to be serious about this and make these steps, that different people groups have different considerations when it comes to, reporting. So for instance, I can't even imagine what someone in, so for instance, we had Eddie Long had some accusers came out and said that they were victims of his. Okay. I can't imagine being in that position as a victim. Just the things that you have to consider at that point, because Eddie Long is not out at this point. So that's one thing that you have to consider when you're saying something. And what if you're not out at this point, you know, then there's different groups of people who are victims of sexual assault have different considerations. And that's why it's important to hear them, them all, listen to them. And it doesn't matter if it makes you uncomfortable. It doesn't matter if this is not you know, you weren't ready to admit this part of it or whatever. Like, these are people who need your support. They need your help. This is something.
And you might need support in offering that support, because I don't think, if we're acknowledging that the organizations themselves have these shortcomings in serving the needs of victims, then we need to be encouraging them to seek out partners that allow them to offer that support. So like we said, we don't want a victim sitting untreated or unacknowledged for any amount of time while, you know, you're going through whatever your investigative or outreach process might be. But you, not only are you not the investigator, you're not the therapist. You're not the wellness professional, if you will. And you might need to get a partner that helps you deliver that service. Mm-hmm. You know, just like a doctor, you know, I'm an eye doctor, not a foot doctor. So I'm going to make a referral, you know, so that you can get what you really need. It to me, it would look the same way, because, and there's something else we didn't acknowledge here, which is that percentage, that very small percentage of when these reports happen, you know, what if they turn out to be false or not accurate? Okay. Mm-hmm. Two totally different things. A complete falsehood, you know, I just made this lie out of the thin air and blah, blah, blah. Not completely accurate. I fudged a couple of details because I was probably more concerned about how you saw me versus how you would see the situation. Whatever your motivation might have been. Acknowledging for all of those things, we are just basically saying that the church to me maintains its power and its reputation when it acknowledges where those things actually lie. So if your power is in supporting others, encouraging them, helping lift them up, then that's the same posture you want to take when there's a member of your body that's hurting, right?
Right.
And if your power rests in, or the strength of your legacy rests in people being able to speak to that effect, that is indeed who you are as an organization, that's the posture that you have to take when you're talking about victims. So you're not, you know, let's... And a lot of that has to do with unlearning these behaviors that scandalize groups.
Mm-hmm.
So when we get out of that scandalizing language and that scandalizing behavior, I think it heals things so that you can be more like the organization you say that you are, or you want people to experience you as opposed to what you keep trying to convince people that you are.
Let me give one other example of trying to help churches think through solutions. So Mike, you just walked through a military example saying there are two different ways to report. So there's some organization that exists inside of the military, inside of many large organizations, where you can report anything that has happened, right? In this case, we're talking about sexual assault. Well, think about the church, right? There's no body that exists
just takes those reports.
That takes that in. And if they do exist, then what you're told is go see Deacon so-and-so, go see Mother so-and-so, or just talk, make a,
that's confidential.
Exactly right. Make a meeting, get a meeting with the pastor, and then tell the pastor about it directly. The problem is half the time it's the people I just mentioned who are actually the aggressor. I think what could help a church is, you know, to your point, I mean, partnering with some organization, some group, it would be an outside group, right? I think the church sometimes has to look outside into the surrounding community to get that help.
Those are those community resources.
So if a church goes into the community and says, man, we really need to find a group of people who we could have, who could just be an outside voice that would come in and they would be able to help us, so that if somebody has an issue, I pick up a phone, I send a text, I do something to get to that group. And then that group, I know, as an outside entity, quote unquote outside entity, at least that would be a help. Because if as a church I only look internally to solve this issue, I don't know that we will ever get it right.
Mm-hmm.
Because there has to be a system in place, in other words, right? And if there's no system to back up our talk, well, then the talk is just cheap.
Right.
We can listen all day, we can be there, we can be supportive. But to point you just made that was excellent, Amira, is if... In 9 times out of 10, the accusation, it's true. It's on point. It's what happened. There's a small percentage, 10%, where maybe some of the details are off. And then there's a smaller percentage where somebody literally just made the whole thing up.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to have a group that can help get you to that point,
yep.
That at least that victim knows, all right, y'all really do care. And I think until we do that, we're still missing it. We can't keep looking inside is the point.
This is a ongoing conversation.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But this is an important conversation and it is overdue. So we will continue to explore how we can be better at this.
Mm-hmm.
And we hope that, that you do too individually and in your collective space spaces, figure out how we can, you know, secure these resources, get these victim advocates, get these people mm-hmm. who are trained to put things in partner to make sure that victims are made whole now. So we will continue this.
Yes, we will. Mm-hmm.
For Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
I'm Amira.
I'm JW.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.